It does seem to be that the two groups are treated differently for no apparent reason.
Groups fighting the oil tax referendum don't need to declare their spending. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage Police Department makes distracted driving a priority.
I see a lot of people looking at their phones. It looks like they're texting and driving, and then they'll put it up to their ear.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Ballot propositions can be expensive fights with hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars spent. The Alaska Public Offices Commission, or APOC, is the group that tracks all that money. Today, they ruled that groups can campaign for or against a pending referendum without declaring their expenditures as long as they aren't sponsoring it. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The differences between a referendum and an initiative are pretty technical. A referendum allows voters to strike down legislation, while an initiative allows them to essentially draft their own bills. But in the end, they're both items that appear on the ballot that allow citizens to shape policy themselves. And so, they were mostly treated the same under law. Here's Tom Lucas, an attorney with the Alaska Public Offices Commission.
It used to be that for referendums, initiatives, and recalls, the same reporting requirements applied to a group that was sponsoring any one of those.
That changed in 2010, when the legislature updated the law so that people fighting an initiative would have to declare things like their expenditures and who was giving the money even during the signature gathering phase. They didn't make a similar change for referenda.
It does seem to be that the two groups are treated differently for no apparent reason.
That's Pat Lavin. He's one of the organizers of a referendum to repeal legislation lowering taxes on oil companies. They're still collecting signatures, but if they get enough, it'll be the first referendum on the ballot in over a dozen years. The oil tax cut is expected to be at least $3 billion over the next 5 years. Given the high stakes, two industry-supported groups are already campaigning against the referendum. Lavin thinks it's unfair that they don't need to do any financial disclosures. He describes it in David and Goliath terms, where a citizen's movement has to play by stricter rules.
They don't need to, so it's definitely an uneven playing field in terms of who's required to report.
While referendum opponents get some advantage from this discrepancy, it still caught them by surprise. Renee Limoge is the treasurer of We Are Alaska, an anti-referendum group backed by the Alaska Support Industry Alliance.
Honestly, we had never looked at the statute for referendums until this happened. So I guess everybody was really unclear as to what was going to happen, including APOC.
So We Are Alaska asked for an opinion from APOC on how they should proceed. In an order issued on Wednesday, APOC concluded that the law doesn't require them to file regular reports until the referendum is certified by the Division of Elections. Until then, they can spend money opposing the repeal without declaring it. Limoge says that she's glad to have some clarity on the matter, but that We Are Alaska plans to submit financial reports anyway.
We are going to file the reports, even though we are not required to, because we do believe that the public has a right to know who's behind this activity. We certainly have nothing to hide in that regard.
We Are Alaska will start submitting reports in July, when the repeal movement hits the deadline for the signature gathering part of the referendum process. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Alaska Native corporations say they're feeling the impacts of congressional scrutiny and new rules for federal contracts. Previously, the corporations, Native American tribes, and Native Hawaiian organizations could enter non-competitive federal contracts of any amount, and the corporations were getting contracts in the hundreds of millions of dollars. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
The Small Business Administration, or SBA, 8A program helped Alaska Native Corporations, or ANCs, win federal contracts totaling $4.4 billion in 2009. That year, Missouri Democrat Senator Claire McCaskill called for an investigation of ANCs and the SBA 8A program and sponsored legislation that requires procurement officers to develop written justification of SBA 8A sole source contracts totaling more than $20 million. Janice Hotch is a manager for the Southeast Alaska Regional Native Corporation, SEA Alaska. She helps subsidiary firms get certified for the program. She says the new rules have had a chilling effect.
Contracting officers, because they don't want, you know, to be put under the spotlight by Congress, they're now just reluctant to issue sole source awards. They're just not wanting to do it.
A December 2012 Government Accounting Office report shows a 60% drop in Native Corporation contract dollars since 2010. The Office of the Inspector General conducted the investigation McCaskill called for. The resulting report said ANC subsidiaries have access to capital and credit not available to typical small businesses, passed most of the work in the contracts onto large non-Native firms, and passed few of the resulting profits onto their shareholders. National 8A Association President Ron Perry says ANCs provide substantial benefits to their shareholders, including cultural programs, jobs, and scholarships. He says the ANCs need the large federal contracts to provide those programs. Plus, he says once you divvy up the small profits from federal contracts among the hundreds or thousands of ANC shareholders, each might get only a couple of hundred dollars.
That's not a meaningful change in anybody's life. That doesn't put anybody through college. That probably will pay for a couple tanks of gas. So when you have to think about it in terms of who you represent, this isn't just one individual. This doesn't go into one individual's pocket. This doesn't increase the stock value of Apple or Coca-Cola or GM or any of those. This actually goes into meaningful lives, elders, youth.
Perry says sequestration has federal agencies cutting profit margins at the same time congressional scrutiny is adding to overhead. The National 8A Association wrapped up a two-day conference in Anchorage yesterday. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Crews have begun cleaning and decontaminating a cargo ship that has been docked in the Port of Valdez for almost 2 weeks after leaking containers were discovered on board. The BBC Arizona's cargo was offloaded into a decontamination area earlier this week. Coast Guard spokesperson Lieutenant Ali Furco says all 28 containers will be removed, whether they are leaking or not.
They're offloaded 8 at a time into a decontamination site where the exterior is cleaned, they're opened. The oil is tested for the presence of PCBs, which we haven't found to this point in the response. Then once all that is complete, we are offloading the oil from the bladders inside the container into something called a frac tank or a temporary storage tank. And then once that is done, the entire container is cleaned and stored in a different part of the Valdez Container Terminal yard.
Furco says the cargo will not go back onto the ship. The cleanup is expected to last through the weekend. The BBC Arizona has been docked at the Valdez Container Terminal since a small fire occurred on board the vessel. The Valdez Fire Department determined the cause was from an ignited leak from one of the containers. The ship was ordered to stay at the terminal until it is cleaned and decontaminated. Hot and dry weather has settled over much of the state. National Weather Service meteorologist Sean Baines in Anchorage says while temperatures are high in the region, they won't break records.
Over South Central, we're looking for hot temperatures for this time of year, but not necessarily records.
The record high temperature in Anchorage is 86 degrees, recorded on June 25, 1953. The forecasted high is 85 degrees for several days next week, but Baines is relatively confident no records will fall because records are measured at the National Weather Service office in the southwest part of the city.
We're going to be much warmer on the east side of town than on the west side of town.
One of the reasons for all that heat, Bain says, is a phenomenon along the coast called offshore flow that keeps the ocean breeze from cooling us off.
That's why it's been so warm in Anchorage and Seward and Valdez and Whittier, all these coastal locations, is this offshore flow that keeps the sea breezes from coming in the afternoon and evening.
Hot weather is also in the forecast for interior Alaska. Bob Fisher is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Fairbanks.
Looks like Fairbanks area and much of the Alaska interior is going to be experiencing a protracted heat wave, which could last, you know, maybe as long as 2 weeks, possibly even longer than that.
Fisher says interior temperatures are forecasted to range between 85 and 90 degrees. A brief break in the heat is possible in the eastern interior Sunday night and Monday, as a cold front may briefly dip down from the Arctic coast. The hot weather and some thunderstorms will increase the fire danger over much of the state, but the National Weather Service isn't predicting the high winds necessary to rapidly spread wildfires. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the unexpected challenges of gardening in the Arctic.
The Inupiaq culture is more of a hunting culture, so if we could shoot cabbages, and people would be, you know, all lining up to do that, we got to grow them instead.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Anchorage Police Department is cracking down on distracted driving, just as a national study highlights the problem. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
We've all been there, stopped at a red light. Whether you're the one texting and then sitting there blocking traffic when the light turns green, or the person stuck in traffic behind them.
A lot of people do it usually during stoplights when their vehicle's stopped, which is still not a good idea. Because then the light turns green and they're still texting, the car sitting there at the intersection and people are honking at them.
That's legal but dangerous, says Anchorage Police Department Officer Patrick Martin, who works in the APD's traffic unit. He sees all kinds of distracted driving, but he says a lot of it involves cell phones.
I see a lot of talking on the phones. I see a lot of people looking at their phones. It looks like they're texting and driving, and then they'll put it up to their ear. You'll see people manipulating the phones with their thumbs like they are texting and driving, and then they realize that someone's looking at them, so they'll put it down in their lap like they're not doing anything.
A law explicitly banning texting and driving in Alaska went into effect in 2012, but there are no other limits on using cell phones while driving in the state. Martin recently attended a distracted driving training seminar put on by the Alaska Peace Officers Association. The training came on the heels of the first fatal texting and driving case in the state since the law was enacted. Earlier this month, an Anchorage teenager was arraigned on charges of manslaughter and felony texting while driving. He's accused of texting behind the wheel, running a red light, and killing a 27-year-old woman in Midtown earlier this year. Martin says the APD is cracking down on distracted driving.
Is it fair to say that you're increasingly cracking down on this?
Yes, we are. We are looking for it. We're out there actively searching out the people who are driving and texting, and we're trying to make a more profound effect to keep our roads safer.
Earlier this week, a study commissioned by the American Automobile Association and carried out by University of Utah researchers sounded the alarm about voice-controlled technology for text messages, emails, and phone calls, saying it's more distracting than listening to the radio or talking with passengers. Officer Martin says voice-controlled technology is a growing problem in Anchorage traffic cases as well. Prosecutors say they've filed more than 30 texting while driving cases in the past year. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Vinaya Mina volcano on the Alaska Peninsula is apparently erupting. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Thursday morning, the Alaska Volcano Observatory upgraded the volcano alert level for the Vinaya Mina volcano to watch due to satellite images that indicate an ongoing eruption. Chris Way Thomas is a geologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory.
What exactly is going on, we're not sure yet. It could be low-level eruption of lava or a hot material of some kind being exploded out, but not going very high. And we still don't see anything in the web camera to indicate any ash emission.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory has been closely monitoring the Veniaminof volcano since Saturday when they noticed elevated levels of seismic activity. Wei Thomas confirms that AVO has a seismic network on the volcano, but it's not functioning at 100%.
It's quite compromised at the moment. There are, I think, 7 stations on the volcano, but only 2 are working at the moment.
The seismic network is solar-powered, and some of the stations have apparently not yet come back online due to snow and ice cover. However, Wei Thomas says that doesn't account for all of the stations.
These stations require regular maintenance, and we've been unable to for a variety of reasons, to get back to resuscitate the station. So some of it has to do with budget cuts and other priorities.
The last time the Veniaminof volcano showed more energetic activity was in 1993 to 1994. AVO notes that seismic activity similar to the ongoing activity last occurred back in 2005. Veniaminof is not the only volcano on the Alaska Peninsula that's currently in an eruptive state. The Pavlov volcano to the southwest of Mount Veniaminof is currently at volcano alert level watch. Wei Thomas confirms that AVO is still detecting elevated seismic activity at Pavlov.
And still elevated surface temperatures at the summit. The eruption is still underway. It's producing low-level ash clouds that are getting, you know, in the 12 to 15,000 foot range. It's impacting local air travel to Cold Bay, King Cove, Sandpoint when the winds are blowing toward those communities. So, it's still going.
You can follow the activity at all of Alaska's volcanoes on the website of the Alaska Volcano Observatory at avo.alaska.edu. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Starting this fall, the University of Alaska Southeast Sitka campus will be inheriting a new degree program. The UAS Fisheries Technology Program will be coming to Sitka from Ketchikan. KCAW's Eric Newman reports.
At the Sitka Sound Science Center, employees are busy checking the water system as they get ready to open a new exhibit about salmon. Students are wandering around the building during a workshop called Getting Kids Excited About Science. But the salmon exhibit isn't the only thing coming to the Science Center. This fall, the UAS Fisheries Technology Program will relocate to this beachfront on the edge of downtown Sitka.
Right here on the water with 3 hatcheries, we're ideally suited for the fish tech program.
That's Jeff Johnston, the campus director with the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is the largest industry in Alaska with over, right now, around 80,000 individuals employed in the industry. So it's a growing industry. It's one of our posters call it a booming industry.
The Fish Tech Program in Sitka will offer a 2-year associate degree or a 1-year certificate in fish culture or fisheries management. Students get skills for jobs like hatchery technicians, field biologists, fish culturists, or fisheries observers. And it's a good fit for the Science Center, which, in addition to the aquarium, operates a full-scale salmon hatchery.
Well, the Science Center and the SJ Hatchery are going to be used really as the kind of the facility on the ground to offer the ability to have students come here and actually get their hands wet and their feet wet.
Lon Garrison is the Aquaculture and Facilities Director at the Science Center, and he'll be teaching classes with the Fisheries Technology Program this fall. Garrison says Sitka offers a lot of opportunities to expand on the current fish tech curriculum.
So we're standing in the incubation room. And the incubators that we use are the same incubators that are used all over Alaska for especially pink and chum salmon.
While we're talking, Garrison walks around the building, pointing out areas that will be used for classes. Big green tanks filled with schools of salmon fry, deep metal sinks where students harvest eggs, and the fish ladder and collecting pools where they'll round up the returning salmon. Garrison also points out a few other ways the facility will help get students ready for jobs in the field.
They're not just going to be dealing with fish. They're going to be working with a lot of PVC, they're going to be working with pumps, they're going to be working with some electricity.
And that's the difference between the Fish Tech program and a Bachelor's of Science program. This is about doing.
The Bachelor of Science program really focuses on the science end of things, right? Learning the biology, and all that's really important. But part of what we do at the Fish Tech program is more of the hands-on stuff.
In addition to hands-on work, the UAS Fisheries Technology Program offers e-learning classes for students interested in working from home. The Fish Tech Program starts in the fall, with applications due in the beginning of August. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Eric Newman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Share your culture and create lifelong connections by welcoming an AFS International Exchange student into your home for a year, semester, or 6 to 12 weeks. Information at 1-800-AFS-INFO. This message sponsored by AFS USA.
Interior Alaska Native leaders shared stories of hardship and messages of hope during addresses at a conference in Fairbanks yesterday. The annual Rural Providers Conference is aimed at eliminating alcoholism, domestic violence, sexual abuse, and suicide through traditional and modern means. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The voices of Alaska Natives who have overcome overwhelming obstacles in their lives shown optimism on a conference that covers some heavy subject matter. Former Tanana Chiefs Conference President and Fairbanks pastor Will Mayo led a session on healing from sexual abuse. In his keynote address prior to the session, Mayo emphasized the importance of telling the truth.
We've been silent so long, and the silence is killing us from the inside. And we have to begin to tell the truth. We have to be honest with one another. We have to open doors of communication that many of our elders told us you don't talk about those things.
Mayo talked about a rough upbringing, being sent to reform school, drinking and toxic relationships, and then dealing with what he was holding inside.
I was a poster boy of dysfunction. I was just a typical sad story that any therapist or psychologist or psychiatrist would just hear my story and say, well, of course. That's the way it goes. But I'm here to tell you that people can change.
Mayo credits finding religion with turning his life around and moving on to help others heal. Current TCC President Jerry Isaac also shared a story about recovering from alcoholism, pointing to the importance of forgiving others and yourself.
Forgiveness is a word, and it's only a word. You gotta put action into it. It's hard. It's very difficult. And, you know, it's a struggle every day with it. But I'm thankful that I do that because now I feel good to me. I still didn't forgive me yet. I feel good to me.
Isaac was followed to the podium by a younger generation Interior Alaska Native leader. TCC's Travis Cole has also beat alcohol addiction and refocused his life on family and helping others. Cole, an artist, presented a large painting of a tree, describing the work's symbolism, starting with the tree's roots.
You know, getting to the root of the problem, you know, finding why do our people feel like drinking or using drugs, or why are they acting out in violent ways? Then we can start to solve a problem and it'll go away. But then, you know, the trunk or the strength is like our community, our people, and we have a strong trunk. And
Cole is providing leaves for conference participants to paint. He plans to apply the leaves to his painting, which will go on display at TCC headquarters. The Rural Providers Conference continues with speakers, talking circles, and workshops. It concludes with a staking ceremony Friday, at which participants drive stakes into the ground, signifying a commitment to sobriety or other wellness goal. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Seth Kantner is known to many Alaskans as the award-winning author of the novel Ordinary Wolves and a collection called Shopping for Porcupine. But in addition to writing, commercial fishing, and professional photography, he's also an Arctic gardener. He says for nearly two decades, he has enjoyed spending time each spring flying seedlings, seeds, and fertilizer to eager village gardeners in communities along the Kobuk River.
So that's going down river from the top is Kobuk, Chungnak, Ambler, Kiana, Norvik. And then the other two villages are Deering and Kivalina, both of which are a little bit cooler, coastal, harder to grow stuff, especially Kivalina.
What kind of plants are you able to grow in these village communities, Seth? We're talking about the Arctic here. So what are people able to successfully grow in the summer, the short season?
Well, there's I could go off in a lot of directions on that. You know, the Inupiaq culture is more of a hunting culture, so if we could if we could shoot cabbages and people would be, you know, all lining up to do that, we got to grow them instead. And so cabbages and turnips and potatoes and carrots and all that stuff grow, but then gardening you'd probably divide up a little because Kobuk is so much like interior weather and country, and then Kivalina, of course, is pretty rugged and windswept. And so up in Kobuk, you can grow gardens, potatoes, carrots, broccoli, cauliflower, all that stuff. The locals for a long time have liked turnips, and I think the miners brought turnips in. They used to salt the turnip greens, and a lot of people like turnips in seal oil, sliced turnips in seal oil, and so those are real popular.
What are you finding today? Is there a growing interest? Is there less interest? Do you have younger people engaged in gardening, or what's the status today?
Well, it's always fun with the kids. They like planting seeds. You can't help it when you got little fingers and you like poking a seed in the ground. It's fun. It seems to be in flux. Ambler's comical that I always joke about there being fights over the plants, but it's pretty close to that. The older ladies there have been gardening for a long time, and they're good at it, and they really like gardening, and so they sort of mob me trying to get the starter plants. And it seems like young people kind of come and go as far as their interest.
So, Seth, what do you grow in your own garden?
Up the river, I've got my parents' old gardens, and so the rhubarb's still growing and raspberries and stuff. And then down here, we use cold frames. So we stuff those garden boxes full of, I just like everybody else, like turnips and carrots and cabbage and stuff like that. Turnips are my favorite, and carrots, and then the really cold soil late in the season makes so they're real sweet. And if you tell a person from Chicago, they about, you know, like turnips, they think you're slightly crazy, but our turnips are better than their turnips.
Seth Kantner is a writer and gardener in Kotzebue. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Eric Newman in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Sarah Bernard from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Speck is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.